in association with Newsarama. Welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, Ron Marz discusses the concept of the legacy hero. You'll hear him compare his Green Lantern creation, Kyle Rayner, to Danny Baptiste, one of the current holders of the Witchblade for Top Cow. The conversation begins with an in-depth look at Witchblade 116, which is a launching point for new readers. But then we'll also discuss Ron's years at Dark Horse, writing for the Star Wars books, his time at CrossGen, particularly about Scion with Jim Chung, The Path with Bart Sears, and of course Sojourn with Greg Land. We'll also get into some future projects, as well as Ron's duties as an editor and writer for Virgin Comics. But right now, the conversation begins with the new starting point for Witchblade, issue number 116, which is already on the racks. First of all, bringing in the new character and stuff, was this something that you came into, or were you part of this decision process to, you know, evolve the story this way? How did that all start?
Yeah, I think it's kind of foggy now, but I believe it was just an idea that we had kicked around at some point. You know, hey, when issue 100 gets here, do we want to... do we want to have a new Witchblade bearer come in and get rid of Sarah? I mean, this was just shortly after I took the book over, this was just kind of an idea that was, you know, kind of thrown out into the deep end of the pool.
Mm-hmm.
And my take on it was, well, I'm just kind of getting used to Sarah and getting to know my way around her character. I don't want to get rid of her by any means.
Okay.
But the idea of having this new character in the series was intriguing to me, so I came up with the idea of, what if we get Sarah pregnant and then have the Witchblade go to somebody else, so that Sarah's still in the book, we can still explore her character, but we have a justifiable reason for somebody else to get the Witchblade, which gives us a chance to sort of tell some ground floor stories and bring a completely new character with a different POV into the story.
Mm-hmm. And was, obviously everyone's going to remember you coming in and bringing Kyle Rayner into the Green Lantern world. I mean, did you get any kind of flack of, here goes Ron Marz again?
One for Tony, right? obviously with Kyle, that was a decision that came down from editorial that we're going to get rid of how you come in here and make up a new Green Lantern for us.
Mm-hmm.
The Witchblade scenario was very different in that I was really left to my own devices to play the storyline out how I wanted to.
Okay.
Although just from my standpoint as a writer, I always like to bring something new and different to a series when I take it over. If I'm coming into an existing series, you know, I kind of figure that, well, if they had just wanted more of the same, they wouldn't have put a new team on the book.
Sure.
You know, if you just want to rehash the same stories that you've been doing for the last 5 years, well, don't hire me. You can just keep the guys that you got in place. just reprint the damn things. So my take on it when I come into a new series is that I want to take the things that work. I want to get my hands on the core concepts and characters that I think are working in the book, move the rest of it out, and then bring in some elements that I feel comfortable with or that I feel like I can do something with. You know, in the case of Witchblade, it was very much, the idea was very much to bring in some new characters, and specifically the new detective character, Patrick Gleason, was put in the book to very much be the point of view character for the readers.
Okay.
Or, you know, his purpose was to come in and say, gee, what the hell's all this, and who are these people, and how does this work? Because that's what we were hoping the audience was going to do. You know, the easiest thing to do on a book is to just keep repeating yourself and pleasing the same audience that you already have. But that also leads to inevitable attrition, because that's just what happens on books. You know, little by little, the readers go away for one reason or another. The only way you can get new eyes on the book is to stir the pot up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, I always feel like you need to throw those new readers some sort of bone that allows them a way into the story. My first issue of Witchblade, Sarah's not even conscious through the whole thing.
Okay.
You know, it's 22 pages of her in a hospital bed in a coma, which when I initially proposed that, you know, I'm sure the guys at Top Cow thought, well, what the hell do we hire this guy for? You know, his best idea is coma. But, you know, it all eventually worked out, and now they're kind of positioning the first arc that Mike Choi and I did on the book as, you know, this is the place to start now, because that's the renumbering and the reissue of the trade paperback program.
Okay. It was Firstborn, obviously, a nice event and everything, the birth of Sarah's baby. It kind of obviously brought in the darkness, and expanded Sarah's place in the Top Cow universe, having, you know, all the players involved in this big event. I assume everything's going along swimmingly as you know, things move on now to issue 116.
So far, so good. I mean, Firstborn really grew out of the Witchblade storyline fairly naturally, in that, okay, Sarah's pregnant. At some point, there's going to be a baby. You know, we weren't going to do something that, you know, we would go through the pregnancy and then, you know, there'd be the baby would be stillborn, or it would be, you know, carried off to Dimension X by aliens or whatever,
okay,
so that we didn't have to deal with it. I wanted to play it fairly straight, and it really, you know, it was one of these situations where we had a story to tell and realized that it would maybe be appropriate to tell it in a crossover event that was outside of the, you know, the regular monthly series, which in my experience is not the way things usually happen. Usually editorial decides, hey, we're going to do a crossover, now make a story. And a lot of times they come out fine, but there's always the event mentality first, the mentality of, you know, we got to have something that's big enough to have a crossover because we've got this hole in the publishing schedule. So Firstborn was a nice break from that, because we had the story already, and then we just massaged it a little bit to make it more of a standalone project.
Tell me about Danny. I mean, now she's got David. Does David serve that same role as Patrick in terms of being the audience point of view and obviously experiencing
something? David serves a role, but we're not going to tell anybody what that is for a couple of issues.
Fair enough. Okay.
He certainly doesn't serve the same role as Patrick Leeson, in that Patrick is kind of an open book for the readers. We know who he is. We know his history. And David is somebody who is a lot more mysterious and has a few more secrets in his past than we've revealed so far.
Okay.
And David will actually be, within the next few issues, we're going to actually dig more into his background and see if he has maybe nefarious purposes on his mind, or if he's just the misunderstood boyfriend.
Okay. 116, when does that hit the newsstands?
I believe that's next week.
Very cool.
Next Wednesday is the sort of, for lack of a better word, I guess, the relaunch of Witchblade with Stepan Sejic taking over as the artist, and we'll be joined at the hip for lo these many years to come.
I notice that. I notice you're committed to the book through 150.
Yeah, at least 150.
Wow.
That was the idea posed to me, and I said, yeah, gee, that sounds great. We've got a lot of stories to tell. And then I sat down and actually thought about it and went, oh, man, that's 2010. What if I just agreed to? But really, I'm not regretting the decision at all. I really like working with him. I like working with the character. And the concept of Witchblade is malleable enough that we can really tell any kind of story we want to. I mean, it's pretty wide open in terms of the kind of genres we can hit and the kind of the different kinds of adventures that we can put the characters through. And just from bouncing ideas back and forth with Stepan, you know, I think we're pretty much nailed down issue for issue until about 135.
Cool.
In terms of specifically where we're going, and then we've got general direction after that, and I think we've frankly talked about enough ideas that we're going to be going past 150 if everything works out right, because he's kind of an idea machine in terms of visuals and design work. So he'll just fill my inbox with stuff on occasion. Hey, how about we do this? What do you think of this as a new villain? And stuff grows very organically between us. So I always think that's the best kind of relationship to have with the guys you collaborate with.
That's cool. Now, I'm a sucker for painted books, and I've always been a Mike Choi fan, but I really enjoyed Stepan's work on this issue 116 that I got the advanced look at. The women are gorgeous, as they should be in Witchblade. And
there aren't too many comics that you find a bunch of real ugly broads running around in. that's an aspect of the book, but it's certainly not an aspect that is in the forefront of my mind. And it certainly wasn't when I took over the book. 4 years ago or whatever it was now, I said to Top Gun when they offered me the book, I said, look, I'm willing to give this a try, but I don't really have any desire to tell stories that are excuses for her clothes to fall off.
Sure.
Because I'm under the impression that they sell magazines with pictures in them for those purposes. So if people want that, there are other places to do it. My mindset was to come in and tell stories that actually made the audience care about the characters and made them want to come back every 30 days to see what happened. And to everyone's credit out there, they've been absolutely supportive of that since day one. You know, there's never been a, hey, can we have a little, can we have a sexy scene here? Can we do some old school Witchblade where she's running around in a metal bikini?
Sure.
That's never come up. We'll do a sexy scene when there's reason for a sexy scene, but for the most part, to me, this book is about a New York City police detective with a lot of supernatural overtones.
No, interesting. Well, and then you do have a couple sexy scenes with Danny and David, and they're kind of interesting, and again, important for the story as well.
That's a necessary aspect of the story, and
sure,
we're not going to shy away from showing that kind of stuff. In fact, I think when we, when we do show that kind of stuff, we'll actually show it. We won't back away from it and get cutesy with, carefully placed soap bubbles in the shower or whatever. but again, it's, that's not what the focus of the book is.
I understand.
Just like anything else. I mean, that's, the sexuality of the book hopefully reflects, sexuality as a part of real life, and we'll have that as a part of the book. But, monsters will jump out of the shadows, too, on a fairly regular basis.
Sure. Were you a fan of the book before jumping into the world? Or the old TV show, even, the TNT show?
To be perfectly honest, which I don't know, I suppose probably most people aren't if they would get this question. I had never actually read an issue of the book when it was offered to me.
Okay.
I had been aware of it, certainly, but had never read an issue, and had seen probably, one or maybe two episodes of the TV series, mostly because I was a fan of Yancey Butler when she was on a CBS show called Brooklyn South.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
But really, it just had never, it was a project that had never been on my radar that much, which I think in a lot of ways is probably a good thing, because I think you see it over and over again in this business where, a guy gets on his dream book, be it an artist or a writer, they get on their dream book and they end up just redoing the stories they read when they were 12 years old.
Certainly. Yeah, being beholden to the creators before them.
Yeah, I think you can certainly look back too much if you end up being a big fan of the material previously. And if you come into it kind of cold, I think you can, you have a little bit more even-handed view of it, an even-handed view of what works and what doesn't. You're not looking at it through 12-year-old eyes. And that's certainly been the case with Witchblade for me, is I'm not really attached to, anything that took place before I came on the book, it all has the same basic value to me, so I can pick and choose the stuff that I think really works. And, you know, and the things that I can't get a handle on, we just sort of leave in the past.
How's the anime? I haven't had an opportunity to see it yet, and I know that the product is out there. And, in fact, I know that Funimation is even making some of the cartoons available through downloads through things like Xbox now as well.
You know, I just got the first three volumes a couple of weekends ago when I was at a signing. Philip Sablik, mm-hmm. Who is now the publisher at Top Cow,
yes,
was at the signings with me, and he said, "Hey, have you seen these yet?" I said, "No, nobody. I haven't gotten my hands on them." So he gave me copies of the first three volumes, which at some point in the near future, I'm going to sit down and watch.
Sure.
So I've just seen, you know, I've just seen stuff on the internet here and there, and I haven't really had a chance to sit down and go through it. But everybody that I've talked to about it says, geez, these are pretty cool.
That's cool.
So I do have plans for a couple of years down the road to maybe not specifically tie into the anime in a crossover sort of sense, but we will be making some nods to what, you know, some of the concepts and some of the characters that are in there.
That's cool. How does your deal with Top Cow work in terms of also your deal with Virgin? Because of course you're editing now at Virgin over and seeing over three books over there. So
well, I'm a happy little freelancer, which means I can work for whoever I want to work for, which is a nice position to be in these you know, exclusive crazed times. You know, mostly what I mostly do for Virgin is editing. What I mostly do for Top Cow is writing. So,
okay,
there's not a huge problem. But you know, frankly, the people at both publishers know each other and are pretty friendly. So it's not a big deal.
That's cool. Well, let's transition to Virgin and talk about those three books that you're overseeing. You're overseeing Devi, and what are the other two titles that you're seeing?
Ramayan Reloaded is the other one, and at present, the Sadhu is the third one, and they're all part of the Shakti line, which are books that are more based on Indian mythology than like the director's cut stuff that they're doing with John Woo or Guy Ritchie,
uh-huh.
or some of the other kind of projects that they have.
Now, I've read, and it's funny because those are the Virgin books that I first sampled.
Obviously, you have good taste.
Well, yeah, Gamekeeper is excellent, and I loved. I've really been enjoying Garth Ennis's Dan Dare. I think, you know, it's. I've seen a couple examples of the old 50s version of Dan Dare, and it's really cool to see Garth take a you know, iconic character like that, and you know, give it the reverence that it deserves, but also give us a nice modern story in that.
Yeah,
Garth Ennis
way. I think it's a Dan Dare in particular. I think it's a worthy take on the concept and the character, but it's not stuck in the past. It's taken a step into, you know, our present at least.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's an obvious you know, affection and understanding of the material.
Absolutely. Well, and these characters you're presiding over, they're new concepts. I noticed Devi has got a Witchblade crossover coming up, so that should be, you know, nice and convenient.
Yeah, that seemed like a natural that just came up one day when, I guess, it might have even been at the New York convention last year when you know, Virgin staff and Top Cow staff happened to be standing around and said, "Hey, how about we do a Witchblade David crossover? That seems to be a natural one." Everybody went, "Yeah, okay, we'll do that." And you know, that's kind of as protracted as the negotiations got, really.
That's cool. Now, and what an interesting company as well, to be led by Gautam Chopra, Deepak Chopra's son, and is Sir Richard Branson involved? I mean, is that the same kind of Virgin, basically? Is it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's Sir Richard's money that is backing the whole thing. Obviously, I suspect he might have a bit more of an eye focused on
Spaceship Two,
you know, Virgin Airways and Virgin Galactic and that sort of stuff.
Sure.
But I know that he, you know, he on occasion will be in New York and and meets with the staff. And at one point, they told me that they had been to lunch with Sir Richard and told him that they had just hired me. So, at some point, my name came up in conversation within Richard Branson's vicinity. So that's good enough for me.
That's pretty cool. Well, and tell me about Gautam Chopra, because I unfortunately didn't see at San Diego back in 2000. Was it 2006 or was it this last year? Where I know he and his father kind of. I listened to the podcast, and it was with Grant Morrison, and then they.
I think that was two years ago now.
Okay, I think it, yeah. So 2006
really. Gautam is really the guy that brought me into the company and that ended up getting in touch with me and. Boy, we probably kicked messages back and forth and phone conversations back and forth for 6 or 8 months before we ever got around to figuring out a deal for me to do some work for the company and what my best use would be for them. Gautam, it turned out, was a fan of a lot of the stuff that we did at CrossGen.
Okay.
And the kind of mythic stuff that we did, and that I particularly did on some of my books at CrossGen, I guess resonated with him, and also with the artists that they've got in the studio in Bangalore. Gautam's told me that a lot of the CrossGen books ended up as part of the studio library because the guys were looking at that stuff and ended up being influenced by the artwork in a lot of the books. So it really grew into an editorial thing where Gautam wanted me to come in and get hold of these books that had that sort of heroic mythic quality very much in terms of the Joseph Campbell Hero with a Thousand Faces work and just that hero cycle that you see in virtually all cultures. That's a lot of the stuff that was sort of the underpinnings of some of the stuff I did at CrossGen. So Gautam felt like that would be a good fit on the Shakti books, and it really is. It's that kind of universal hero stuff works as an underpinning for virtually any story you're going to tell. It's got the heroic aspect to it.
Well, and that I was wondering that because, yes, the books are based in Eastern mythology, but as you say, a lot of mythology is universal, and it is the hero's journey. So was it more a discovery of, them coming to you and saying, well, this is the way we've done it in Eastern mythology, and you saying, oh, well, that's great because, that's the kind of thing that Campbell would say and kind of put it in Western language or Western, is there much of a translation in terms of the basic storytelling?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think it's we don't call it universal for nothing.
Sure.
you dress it up in different clothes, and you dress it up with different details. But whether it's Beowulf or Siegfried or Luke Skywalker or Rama from Ramayana, it's really the heroes go through a lot of the same journey. And I think having kind of had that as a basis for a lot of the writing that I've done and the journey of the hero in becoming the hero is a lot more interesting than after he's become the hero.
Okay.
I think a lot of comics tend to be about what's happened after the hero has sort of come to be the hero.
I mean, maturity. Yeah.
You get Superman's origin in 3 or 4 pages, and then he's Superman.
Right.
Then you just tell stories of him, beating guys up, basically. Whereas most of the world's mythology is really about how that hero becomes the hero.
Sure.
So comics are, in a lot of ways, are cyclical, whereas the hero mythology definitely is a forward looking story, because the hero starts off as, you know, the uncertain boy, or, you know, or woman, and becomes that, you know, that primal hero by the end of the journey.
Well, and I guess we're seeing that too in Witchblade now as well, with Danny's journey, as opposed to where Sarah being the, you know, going to a new point in her career as a mother now, and kind of dealing with the balance of that.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's Witchblade is cool because I can deal with both ends of the spectrum. I can deal with the hero as hero, but now dealing with, you know, with motherhood, and I can also deal with, you know, the hero in the making, which is Danny. You know, a lot of times I wish I had, you know, had more than the standard page count every month, because I've got more story to tell than that.
Yeah, this first issue, 116, is 32 pages. And I'm assuming then, now do you go back to the normal 22, or is it always 32 in Witchblade?
No, well, we added extra pages into issue 116 just because we had more story to tell.
Sure.
And truthfully, once I got done with the script, we all sat down, took a look at it, and decided that we wanted more of a ground floor read.
Sure.
For people who might be picking it up for the first time because of the new artist starting. So I actually rejiggered some things and added a 5 or 6 page sequence at the beginning of the book that really kind of sets the stage for what the Witchblade is, mm-hmm. and who these characters are. You know, we didn't want to just do a standard, you know, kind of encyclopedic kind of rundown of, well, this is what the Witchblade is, and this is who Sarah is, and this is who Danny is. So I found a way to kind of gracefully thread that information into the story so that, you know, it's kind of like you're learning something, but you don't actually know you're learning something.
Oh, yeah. No, it beats a one-page text, you know, kind of recap. So no, I think you did a good job. And Stefan, that's gorgeous art, man. It's a nice jumping on point, definitely. So and I appreciate the mystery that you've opened up as well, which I think will appeal to the crime fans, and you know, it certainly has a mythic side to it. But I think you've opened up an interesting police case for Sarah to delve into here.
Yeah, I wanted to get this first issue with Stepion, and I wanted to get, you know, it's kind of the kitchen sink issue, and that I wanted to get in everything that I feel like works with the book, which is, you know, Sarah, Danny, police stuff, supernatural stuff, some pages where we can really show off his art to best effect, and a mystery element that hopefully hooks everybody and brings them back for the next issue, because the story ultimately will unfold to include what Sarah's doing, what Danny's doing, and everything will kind of all the threads will start to come together towards the end of 117, and then we'll put a bow on it with 118.
Oh, it's only a 3-issue arc. I was going to ask how long.
Yeah, it's a 3-issue arc.
Okay,
and then we have a one off issue that's actually going to bring back the Aphrodite character for an issue.
Okay.
Which is going to be just balls to the wall action, from, you know, from beginning to end. Although I guess actually nobody in the story has balls. So, and then issue 120 is going to start a 6-part arc that will, you know, as they say, change Witchblade forever.
Wow. Okay. Very cool. Tell me about the writers that you're working with and the artists from. Virgin, and you know, I mean, how much contact do you have with them, and any language barriers or any,
you know, daily basis, really. I mean,
okay.
The beauty part of the job is that I, you know, I sit here in my office at home, and I, you know, and I do that aspect of the job as well. It's not like I have to, you know, show up at the Virgin offices or punch a time clock or anything like that.
Okay.
I had enough of that. That whole experience at CrossGen.
I bet, yeah.
You know, coming into the office every day had its rewards, but I ultimately think I'm I'm a work at home kind of guy.
No, I understand. I think that whole experience had to have been strange, and I can appreciate on paper what Alessi was trying to do in terms of creating a studio and almost having a kind of company idea, and also the idea too that, hey, if someone's behind, all you got to do is go to the next cubicle and they can, you know, maybe, you know, you can get an anchor or a pencil or whatever to kind of pitch in just to make things, you know, go on schedule. But then again, I understand as well. I've freelanced and I've you know, worked in a regular business setting as well, and it is. It's a different head, and I think it's not for everybody either. And I don't know if it necessarily helps creatively when you're fighting the clock in that way versus having the luxury of sitting around and being able to really gestate an idea. And you know, if it comes to you at two in the morning, so be it.
Well, if you're doing a monthly book, you got to produce that monthly book in the time allotted, whether you're, you know, sitting at home in your underwear or you're in a studio somewhere.
Sure.
I think creatively, the cross-gen concept was worked pretty well.
Okay.
It was flawed in its business design.
Yes.
But I think in the creative design, for the kind of people that we had in the building, it really worked pretty well. Because for the most part, the artists and writers were people who had experience in the business, knew what they were doing, and valued the job security,
sure,
the benefits, and all that kind of stuff.
Certainly,
that were part and parcel of the deal. It wasn't an accident that most of the artists and writers who went down there were guys with families.
Yeah,
it was not the kind of place that was set up per se for 18-year-old kids to who wanted to run around and play video games.
I understand.
15 hours a day and then squeeze their work in the rest of the time. It was really a bunch of guys who were there to do their work, and that was actually a learning curve for the management of the place. We're all going to sit here and do our work anyway, whether you make us show up at 9 o'clock or you don't give a damn when we show up.
I got you. You know,
it's going to get done because this is what we want to do.
Right.
You know, this isn't like, punching out Buicks in the factory in Flint. It's something that, you know, virtually everybody in that building, you know, if you handed them $1 million tomorrow, they'd still get their page for the day done because that's what they love to do.
Well, I got to tell you, man, I really, as long as that experiment lasted, I really loved a lot of cross-gen books, and a lot of them wound up on my pull list, and a lot of yours did, too. Scion was just fantastic, and I really appreciated the nod to Hal Foster and Prince Valiant that I think you and Jim Chung achieved, and especially directly when you guys even did that one book that had each page looking like the old Sunday Prince Valiant strips. I just thought that was awesome. But it was a great blend of sci-fi and fantasy. And again, the young hero's journey of learning his power as he moves along.
If gun to my head, if I had to pick a favorite book, Scion was probably it.
Well, I was going to also say The Path as well, man. We can stick on Scion for a minute because, yeah, believe me, I want to give The Path its due because I love that one as well.
Well, Scion was really, when Mark Alessi started talking to me about the job, that was one of four, actually probably 3.5 concepts that had been worked out, mostly
before
by
you got
Mark.
There? Oh, okay.
And it was obviously it came from a lot of the stuff that he liked to read as a kid, which was, you know, Prince Valiant and, Kubert's Viking Prince.
Okay.
And, you know, sort of the non-superhero aspects of Marvel and DC books all the way back into the 50s, I guess, really.
Sure.
So there was a template in place for Scion, but really it had a fairly cliched setup initially that we tried to work away from.
Okay.
And we got, you know, we got a fair amount of freedom once we, you know, you learned how to, you learned how to play the game, and you got you know, you knew what you could get away with ignoring and what you couldn't. Really, I got to come in and take my pick of the initial book concepts, and you know, Cyan was going to be the deal breaker. If I didn't get to do that, I just wouldn't have even bothered. and then having you know, having, I guess, essentially my pick of the artist too.
Nice pick.
To say, you know, yeah, Jim Chung and Brandon Peterson. Okay, I can start with those two fellas.
Not bad, man. Not bad. Yeah, exactly. And I forgot about Brandon. That's right. Because yeah, they both did a great job, and I continue to enjoy both of their work as well as they've moved on.
Yeah, I mean, they're just great guys, and I mean, to me, Jim, I mean, Brandon was terrifically good when he got there. That was why he was there. But Jim, I think his stuff was still pretty, you know, pretty raw at that point, and the growth that he exhibited, even just in the first year of that book, to me is still one of the most stunning things I've ever seen. And I think, I mean, to me, Jim is easily one of the three or four best guys working in the business right now. He might not be the fastest penciler.
Sure.
That anybody's got on staff, but
I understand.
But man, he's good. I would walk across broken glass to work with Jim again.
No, and I think you're right, and I think Bendis and Alan Heinberg would be right there to agree with you in the work that they've done with him so far.
Yeah, Jim's just good at everything. He's the stuff is beautiful. It has immaculate storytelling. Jim, you know, is such a meticulous craftsman. Which is one of the reasons he's not on a strict monthly book, is that he just can't keep up that schedule because he's such a meticulous craftsman. You know, every page that we did on Cyan was really better than the last one, and I guess that Prince Valiant issue was the last one we did, and we knew it was going to be the last one. We wanted to kind of go out on a high note, and I knew I was going to leave the book after that because I didn't want to do the book without Jim.
Okay.
So I actually had the idea of doing, you know, like the Sunday style broadsheet layout for the issue. And I went to Jim and said, you know, how about we do a Prince Valiant issue for the last one. And, you know, I'll write blocks of text, and it, you know, it'll be set up like a Sunday page. And he went, oh, yeah, okay, sure, that sounds great. And then, you know, and then a month or two later, when it actually came down to executing and writing the script, you know, I sat down with Jim and said, okay, this is how it's going to work. And he said, oh, okay, I think I can handle this, because when you initially said, you know, Prince Valiant, I had no idea what you were talking about. Because he, you know, Jim's British. He, you know,
okay.
He grew up in London. He never saw Prince Valiant. He didn't have a clue what I was talking about, but he agreed to it anyway.
Well,
you know, and then obviously sat down and educated himself with all the Fantagraphics reprints of what we were, you know, what we were about to do. And I mean, to me, those are still some of the most gorgeous pages I've ever been involved in.
Yeah, I don't blame you, man. Yeah, and for people who are listening who don't know what we're talking about, do yourself a favor and Google Hal Foster, Prince Valiant, and I'm sure you'll be able to find a good example of one of his Sunday pages, if not purchasing those Fantagraphic reprints, because they really were. They were spectacular. And, you know, Alex Raymond, I guess, kind of did the same thing, I think, with Flash Gordon.
I think the Flash Gordon stuff is miraculous too, but I don't think anybody has ever surpassed the Prince Valiant stuff. I mean, I've actually seen some of the Foster originals for Prince Valiant.
Yes.
I mean, you know, the things are the Sunday pages are just, they're like the size of a mattress.
Yes.
Huge, you know, these huge originals, and the originals for the Cyan issue were done on double spread paper, which at CrossGen, because we had most everybody working in studio, we could have double spread paper printed up on one big board rather than two boards taped together, which is how pretty much everybody else had to do it because they were being shipped back and forth.
I see.
So Jim drew all those pages on, you know, really big boards turned on their sides.
That's really cool.
And they're, yeah, I mean, the originals are breathtaking to look at. I still, actually, I think Jim is still holding one for me that I have to get from him. And Dave Lanfear, the letterer, was going to go through and actually put all the lettering on the board, too.
Oh, that's really cool.
So that you would have the whole page in front of you.
That's not, that'll take up a wall. That'll be good.
Yeah, that'll take up some office space.
Well, and, you know, I love The Path because I thought the story was great. And it was cool because at the same time you had Way of the Rat and you had what was the other one? Was it just Way of the Rat and The Path? Were those the two?
Yeah, they were, you know, basically taking place on the same world.
Right. And, yeah, and that was Chuck Dixon and Jeff Johnson. And I thought your writing was great, but I also really appreciated a very different side of Bart Sears' art because I really felt that was – very different from anything else that he was doing, including his work on the first over at CrossGen and subsequent superhero work. I mean, these were not, you know, Charles Atlas bodies in this work. And also, I really felt that a lot of the art had a very cinematic look to it. And you know, you guys kind of took advantage of what now is very common. I mean, you know, I know that Brian Hitch and Miller got a lot of credit for Ultimates kind of having a very big screen kind of look. I thought you guys were doing that years before on things like The Path.
Well, it was fortuitous in that Bart and I have been friends forever. I was the guy who called Bart and said, hey, you know, do you want to come down here? And I think when everybody thinks of Bart's work, they do think of the, you know, the big muscled figures, you know, like he did on the first, like he did on Justice League Europe.
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of his signature style. So that's what people expect. But if left to his own devices, Bart would much rather work in the style that we used in The Path, which was a lot more blacks, a lot more indicated than actually drawn. Lots of heavy shadows. Mm-hmm. That's more of the kind of work that he prefer to do. Although, you know, on a lot of jobs, he ends up having to draw in the sort of expected style because that's the commercial style. So for the Path, we were kind of left to create that from, you know, pretty much the ground floor up as well. And, you know, that's a great opportunity to be given to not have such a heavy editorial hand over you because I think the work comes out better. If you're doing something that you're excited about, the work takes on a life of its own rather than the creators just feeding into, you know, the icon, the company brand, whatever the character happens to be.
And Sojourn, let's briefly talk about that because that seemed to be, you know, everyone I think was kicking themselves when that book came out, I bet the other companies, in terms of, yeah, why isn't there another kind of Hobbit-style book out there or, you know, that kind of fantasy book? And it is kind of crazy that there was really nothing like it on the market until that first showed up.
Well, this was, you know, definitely a year or so before Lord of the Rings ever hit the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously that's one of the books that I read and loved as a kid and as a teenager. And, you know, it was a big part of the kind of storytelling tradition that I grew up on. Because as a kid, I read a lot more books without pictures than I did, you know, books with them. So, you know, I read Robert E. Howard and Tolkien and Michael Moorcock and all of that heroic fiction a lot more than I did comics. So when Lord of the Rings became a movie reality or was in the process of becoming a movie reality, I thought, you know, we got to have a book. I mean, this is what the audience out there is going to be looking for, or at least, you know, we'll have an opportunity to put this kind of material in front of the audience, and maybe it'll be a little more accepting than it generally is. I mean, I think generally the comic book audience wants their superheroes, you know, wants their comfort food, and once in a while we'll try something else new and different, but not all that often.
Okay.
So I felt like the impending release of Lord of the Rings, which was obviously going to be a huge deal, gave us kind of an opportunity to get that kind of book out there. And Greg Land was coming on staff. And originally he had been hired to take over Meridian.
Okay.
Which Steve McNiven ended up taking over, and really, you know, Steve McNiven became Steve McNiven at that point. So the initial idea of bringing Greg Land in to do Meridian, I went into the boss and I said, you know, he's like the last guy you want to put on a book about a 14-year-old girl. It's just not going to work. And I'm sure it would have been a beautiful book, and Greg could have pulled it off, but I said, you know, knowing Greg a little bit, I knew the kind of stuff that he really wants to draw, which is, you know, the stuff that you can, find in Universal horror movies. You know, big old castles and monsters and pretty damsels in distress. I said, let me build a book for Greg and I to do that is kind of a high fantasy that we can do month in and month out. And the boss said okay, and I went into my office, and 2 days later came out with basically what Sojourn was, the different races and the different lands and, you know, the whole thing kind of from whole cloth. And I had to sit down and pitch it to the boss, and he went, I don't think this is going to work. I don't think people want this.
Huh.
And I said, in a year, they're going to want it.
Yeah.
You know, by the time we get this book out there, they're going to want it. So trust me on this. And grudgingly, he said, okay. But before I left the office, he said, by the way, put a dog in it. And I went, what? And he said, put a dog in it. People like dogs. And I said, you realize a dog is a huge pain in the ass in terms of a story because, you know, if the heroes have to climb up a ladder to get away,
yeah,
the dog is a problem. You know, if they have to, if they have to climb down a rope to get away,
yeah, that's
the dog is a problem. But that was his sticking point. You want to do the book? Put a dog in there.
What kind of dog was it? I totally forgot about the dog.
And he said, make it this kind of dog, because that was a dog that he had earlier in his life. And
I
name
remember
it
that.
This.
That's right.
And what? I went, okay. You know, knowing how the process worked, I knew that was not going to be a give back. I was going to have to deal with that, and I could do pretty much whatever else I wanted, but I was going to have the damn dog in there.
That's when you got to find Bob Haney at a convention and go, all right, talk about Rex the Wonder Dog for a second.
Yeah.
How the hell did you do it?
So, you know, Greg came in and he went, oh, cool, monsters and you know, beautiful archer and castles. And then he said, what the hell, a dog? I said, that's our price of admission, buddy.
Well,
so
luckily.
We dealt with the dog and... I lasted on that for a couple of years, and it was fun all the way through. It was very much a learning experience for me because it was the first time I was doing a real big fantasy concept. Cyan was more science fiction, and obviously The Path was more of a samurai story. So mm-hmm. Sojourn was my first time really putting together a fantasy story. So, I can look back and see the stuff that worked and the stuff that didn't. So at some point in the future, I would love to do another one of those and not do the things that didn't work and concentrate on the ones that actually did.
And is there still that hesitation from publishers, or do they see, obviously, with the success of the Lord of the Rings films, that maybe, you know, there is room for that kind of, you know, fantasy book again?
Well, I suppose... In the long run, you'd have to ask the publishers, but you look at previews every month, and it's 90% superheroes and then 10% other stuff. So I guess to great extent, that's your answer. I think in general, the market just does not embrace stuff that's not like I said before, comfort food.
No, I understand.
The audience wants what it wants, and I think the retailers and the readers are a lot more prone to keep, you know, reading a Spider-Man book or a Batman book or an X-Men book that they don't like than they are to try something new and different.
As an older reader, I kind of always do kind of welcome the non-tights concepts, and you know, you've always been a writer that has always seemed to have been able to, you know, do both well. Kyle Rayner was a great character, and I think you came in under fire and still produced a character that obviously means a lot to a lot of people and continues to mean a lot to a lot of people in the DCU.
First of all, thanks. I mean, it's kind of you to say. With Green Lantern, I really got handed a I don't want to say a foolproof opportunity, but, you know, an opportunity that had a lot of upside to it because I got to, yes, introduce a brand new character, but I also got to play with all the toys that were already in place. You know, I got the sort of Green Lantern mythology and everything that the background and the secondary characters that came with it, and I got to create a character that I was very comfortable writing right in the middle of it. So, you know, that was a great experience, and whenever I get a chance to go back and play with Kyle, if, you know, schedule permitting and project being right and all that, I do so because I do feel probably far more sense of ownership of that character than I justifiably should. I know ultimately at the end of the day, you know, Kyle belongs to DC just
sure.
like Hal does and Superman does and Batman does and all that. But, you know, when you write a character for, I guess it was almost 7 years or just about 7 years, you do tend to really become attached to them, especially if you've sort of brought them into the world and helped them grow up a little bit.
Well, and I think Kyle was, especially of that generation of new characters, he's the one that stuck the best, and I think that's a testament to the way you wrote him, because I'm a Hal Jordan fan, and I'm an Alan Scott fan for that matter as well, but I kind of grew up being a Hal Jordan fan. But the timing was right, where there needed to be a change in the book. A next step had to happen. It was fun to see the mythology start up again from the beginning with a new hero, and I'm sure that I hope Witchblade fans feel the same way with the introduction of Danny. Now you're back on the hero's journey again.
Well, yeah, I mean, to a great extent, comics and especially superhero comics are cyclical. You know, the Fantastic Four always ends up fighting Doctor Doom. Sooner or later, Doom shows up,
sure.
and there's a big fight. Sooner or later, you know, Batman punches the hell out of the Joker and drags him back to Arkham. That's
right.
just that's the nature of the business, really. And when comics were really seen as you know, fodder for 10-year-olds until they discovered Cars and Girls, you know, that 4 or 5 year window when that 10-year-old was growing up, all of those stories were new to that 10, 12, 14-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they hadn't seen the Fantastic Four fight Dr. Doom over and over again. So the first time he sees it, it's the coolest thing since sliced bread. Now with a lot of the audience being older, a lot of the audience being around for 20 or 30 years,
yep.
you know, you don't have the same luxury of just repeating yourself. The industry as a whole can't just keep trotting those old tropes out because the audience calls them on it. The audience says, well, wait a minute, I read this story 12 years ago. Why am I reading it again?
Right.
And a certain part of the audience doesn't mind that. They want to read the same stories over and over. There's
sure.
there's a comfort factor to it. But yet, if you want to pull new readers into what you're doing, you have to come up with something new and different once in a while. You know, I think Kyle was part of that in that I end up signing a lot of books for people at shows or at store appearances or whatever who say to me, you know, this was the first comic I ever read, you know, holding up one of Kyle's first adventures or first issues, or this was the first DC book I ever read. I think that that sense of the new that you get when you kind of, you know, kick a franchise in the ass and do something different attracts a new audience, and that audience will stick with you for a while. I know a lot of I know there's an audience out there for whom Kyle is always going to be the Green Lantern because that's the one they grew up with.
Sure.
Just like, you know, the previous generation, Hal was always going to be Green Lantern for them because that's the audience that grew up with him.
Well, and I'm glad that DC has finally figured out that there's room in the universe for both of them, and actually all five of them. I mean, you know, and really now with the Green Lantern Corps back in full swing, all 3,000 and however many there are right now. So it's a great concept. Did you ever read those Doc Smith Lensman books? It's funny. I think Julie Schwartz never really copped to the fact that there's just too many similarities there for that have not been in his mind.
Oh, yeah, and certainly the circles that Julie moved in, you know,
exactly.
Like
exactly.
Those were unaware that he was unaware of those. I actually never did read those read the lens. Maybe I've read one of them.
They're kind of creaky. I mean, they really are like products of their time. They really are 1930s stories. And
oh yeah, absolutely.
Don't hold up as well as maybe even some of the Shadow and Doc Savage stuff, which I think, again, depending on the age of a reader, may not be able to read as easily as someone like yourself who wrote Robert Howard stuff, just like I did when I was a kid.
Yeah, so. I mean, I certainly I found a lot more appeal in the Shadow and especially Doc Savage, which I read pretty voraciously as a
Me
kid.
Too. Yep.
Whereas like the Lensman stuff, maybe I did come across one and went, that's okay, but it wasn't it didn't really curl my toes as much as the Man of Bronze.
Yeah, I'm with you. Are there characters at the Big Two that you haven't had the opportunity yet with that you'd still like to get a crack at? Are there any burning stories?
I've gotten to play with most of the toys in one form or another, whether in a crossover or so. If I get hit by a bus tomorrow, I'm not going to feel like I'm unfulfilled because I didn't get to write my Speedball story. But I guess the characters that I'm really drawn to are the ones that are the iconic ones, Superman, Batman, Spider-Man. I think, to me, those are characters that work in whatever era you're dealing with. They're really sort of classic American fictional icons at this point, I don't think you even have to quantify it as American. I mean, I think those three characters, maybe to a certain extent, the Hulk, to me, are the same sort of fictional icons as Tarzan, Sherlock Holmes, the Three Musketeers. So I think you can do so much with any of those characters because conceptually they're very, they're so strong and they're malleable. You can tell a lot of different kinds of stories. So those are the characters that appeal to me. And because of when I started reading comics, or started reading comics seriously, I think Daredevil is always a character that is kind of an itch that I want to scratch at some point.
That's cool. Well, that'd be interesting.
The first comics that I ever really looked at with more of an adult eye were Miller's Daredevil and Simonson's Thor. I mean, those were the first two books that I think I plucked off a spinner rack when I was in high school.
That's cool.
And, started to read comics again. So those really are the ones that started me, doing what I'm doing now.
That's excellent. I have to mention Star Wars if I can real quick, because
sure.
You certainly, made your imprint known over at Dark Horse on their books. Is that something that you might be going back to at some point?
I don't know. I always liked the Star Wars stuff. And had truthfully flirted with it a few times prior to when I actually got to work on it. When Dark Horse got the Star Wars license, the editor was a guy I had worked with a couple times, and just after they got the Star Wars license, he called me up and said, "Don't tell anybody, but we did the deal. We got the license. We're gonna start up a Star Wars monthly book. Do you want in? Do you want to be the guy to write it?" And I said, "I just signed an exclusive contract with DC 2 days ago." There was, you know, that was my first lesson on exclusives, really. eventually, I guess between the end of my exclusive with DC and going down to CrossGen, I got my hands on a number of the Star Wars books and just had a ball doing it. I know you sort of hear rumor and innuendo about working with licensed properties being a real pain in the ass, and you know you have to jump through all sorts of approval hoops and all that. And I really didn't find any of that to be true. For the most part, I got to tell the stories I wanted to tell, and there was not a whole lot of interference from Lucasfilm. There was just some guidance, as there is any time you're playing with somebody else's toys. You know, really, I didn't find Star Wars to be that different from, you know, from working within the Marvel and DC universes. If anything, the Star Wars stuff was a little bit more specific, and you could look up the timelines and get even a better sense of, you know, what happened when and sort of work with the continuity, because it all made a little more sense than Marvel and DC.
Sure. Well, and certainly less, you know, less out... not as many creators, and so it was, yeah, I think probably more of a tight map in terms of the few things that were out there, but also, yeah, a clearer map as opposed to the various reboots that DC and Marvel have had to go through every
yeah,
generation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Luke Skywalker isn't perpetually 35 like Bruce Wayne is. So some of that stuff is easier to deal with. And I also, just in terms of writing the characters, I felt like, you know, when you write Darth Vader or Darth Maul or, you know, any of the established characters that have been in the films, you know how they act, you know how they talk. You really have a very strong roadmap in terms of what you're going to do with these characters, because, you know, they're so ingrained in our culture. Writing a Darth Vader story was just the coolest thing in the world, because you knew what the dialogue sounded like coming out of his mouth even as you were writing it.
I bet. I feel like I've taken you, like it's like a cab ride, and I've taken you around the park enough times, because we're at an hour, and I want to thank you for your time, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you.
No problem, John.
Witchblade 116 looks great, and continued success with that, and your work on the Virgin books as well. And as always, as I say, I enjoy your superhero work, but I'm always happy to see you doing non-superhero work as well. So here's hoping
I always kind of say that, you know, man doesn't live by superheroes alone. I like pizza, but I don't want to eat it every night either.
There you go.
Variety is great. So if I can get up on Monday and work on a Witchblade script, and then Tuesday edit some stuff for Virgin, and Wednesday work on some creator-owned stuff like Samurai Heaven and Earth or Pantheon City. To me, I've got the best job in the world, because if I get bored, it's my own damn fault.
Is there? Have we missed anything? Is there anything coming up that you wanna acknowledge that we haven't had a chance to talk about?
Oh, I'm sure there's plenty. I'm doing a. I never leave the house. There's got to be plenty. I'm doing a. Writing a miniseries for Virgin called Deepak Chopra's Beyond, which is really an adaptation of a film script that Gotham's dad, Deepak Chopra, mm-hmm. wrote. So they sort of entrusted that to me. I think the first issue will be out in May, and it's kind of a, you know, cross-dimensional, metaphysical kind of adventure. And I'm working my way through that. We're at Top Cow. We're going to do a kind of a sequel to Firstborn called Broken Trinity.
Okay.
Which is this summer's crossover, and it'll follow much the same, much the same parameters, in that it's, you know, it'll be a three-issue crossover series with a couple of tie-in issues, but we're going to keep it lean and mean, just like we did with Firstborn. We've got a Firstborn Aftermath issue coming out that I did a story, a Magdalena story with Ryan Suk.
Oh, cool.
Who is absolutely one of my favorite artists.
You bet, man.
And the thing just looks just stunning. And then later on this year, both of my creator-owned books at Dark Horse will start appearing again. We'll do a third volume of Samurai Heaven and Earth.
Outstanding.
With Luke Ross and myself, which is just one of my pride and joys. I love the book. I love working with Luke. You know, that's like the cherry on my creative Sunday whenever I can get to that.
Very cool. I didn't mention it, but I will tell you, I have enjoyed it. And if it was a good, for me, it was a good follow up to The Path, and to see you then go to Dark Horse and write Samurai. It's a different book, but I just enjoyed it. So, and I love Luke Ross. He's awesome.
One of the great things about working with Dark Horse is that, you know, they're open to, you know, non-superhero, non-spandex stuff. They don't really want that stuff to great extent, because they know that the people that want superheroes are going to read Marvel and DC, and that's one-stop shopping for them. So you can take a historical adventure like Samurai, the Dark Horse, and they're willing to take a plunge. And then the other thing I'm doing for Dark Horse is Pantheon City, which was actually in last year's Free Comic Book Day book from Dark Horse, and we're still working on it. Hopefully, we'll get the series starting to come out this year. And I'm working with Clement Salve, is an artist from Montreal, on that, and it's just amazing looking stuff. And it's coming along fairly slowly, so that's why we haven't seen it yet. But
what's the concept of that?
It's a sort of near future science fiction book, in which a man-made city has been built off the coast of the United States. As kind of a haven for people to come to and start over, and it's got robot policemen and robot trash cleaners, and it's the city of the future. And it was a self-built automated city. An artificial intelligence was created to design and build the city, as sort of the next generation of cities in the world, and part of what was actually designed and built by the city, by the artificial intelligence, is a protector. Just like Metropolis has Superman and Gotham has Batman, Pantheon City has a protector as well. But it's kind of a wild card in the system, and the actual Pantheon Corporation isn't real crazy about it.
Oh, that's cool.
So there's a 9-foot robot running around in the city doing good deeds, but that's not necessarily what the corporation wants to happen.
Very cool. And that's a miniseries or a...
Yeah, that'll be a 4-issue mini.
Very cool. That's great, man. Well, there you go. Good slate of books coming up for Ron Mars. And
keeps me off the streets.
Well, I appreciate your time, man. I thank you very much.
No problem, John. It's a pleasure.
That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. This is John Suntress. Thanks a lot for listening. Don't forget, you can find Word Balloon all over the internet. We're at, of course, newsarama.com. You can find us at iTunes as well. We have our MySpace page, myspace.com/wordballoon. Our ComicSpace page, comicspace.com/wordballoon. And if you ever have any questions or comments about the show, you can reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2008.